Let's get starting. We've lost a few minutes there. So I want to talk about three things today, three sort of effects or interesting effects, I'd say, in quantum theory. So the first one is the no cloning theorem. The second one is quantum teleportation. And the third one is the quantum Zeno effect. Okay. So, and they're all very simple. I would say. Let's get started. Okay. The no cloning theorem. So this theorem has an interesting history. What happened is back in about 1982, a guy called Nick Herbert put out a paper which claimed to be able to signal faster than light using quantum entanglement. And it turned out that, the reason he was able to do that is he was assuming that you could clone quantum states. So this paper went to various referees, the referees, spotted the mistakes in the paper, and then, so this seems louder than usual. And then, so the no cloning theorem came out of that. So so Nick Herbert wrote a wrong paper. If you're going to write a wrong paper, it's worth writing one that has, interesting consequences, I think, like this. It's interesting in physics. We put so much stock in being right, but sometimes you can make interesting mistakes. The paper that's usually quoted for the no cloning theorem itself is Wouters and Zurek. Girardi was one of the referees of this. Nick, I think all these people were of this paper. And also Deeks. Also came up with the no cloning theorem in response to this paper. Okay, so it's a very simple theorem. Imagine we have a machine that can clone quantum states. In some Hilbert space. So this means if we send in a state into this machine, then it evolves to a situation where you have the original state and then a copy of that state, and then you have the machine afterwards I'll write this down and then unpack it. So then you have this afterwards. So here's the machine in its original state. You send in psi, for example. You get two copies of psi out, one in on particle A1, the original particle 1 on particle A2. And then you have this is a 4. The machine is left. The machine may be in a different Hilbert space afterwards because it's, in fact, it would have to be because it's outputted a system. And the machine may be in a different state afterwards as well, which may depend on the original, on the state you're trying to clone. Okay. Now, this machine should clone for all states. So in particular, it should also work for some other state. Let's write like so. Okay, so this is now just denoting two different instances of states in that Hilbert space HA. Any questions at this stage? Yep, go ahead.
I was wondering, since the labels B3 that represents the particle system, I was wondering why after the cloning.
Yeah.
Why we don't just say M prime B3, for example, but we wrote C4. So
yeah.
I was wondering why we change the system.
I'll mention a different way to have done it later, which it may be clearer with regard to your question. But the total Hilbert space is fixed. So the total Hilbert space is H A1 cross HB3, and that's got to be equal to the one you get afterwards, which is C4. Okay, so this Hilbert space, the one you have initially, should be equal to the one you have afterwards. Okay. And so, really, this is just HB3. So it's just a way of denoting that. A different way to have done it would have been to have kept the machine having a constant Hilbert space and allowed an initial blank. So I could have instead written it like this. And that would have worked as well. So I have the initial state, some blank copy of the Hilbert space in the zero state initially, and in the machine. So that is maybe a clearer way to think of things. It amounts to the same thing. Okay. And these are unitary transformations. Okay. Let's just. So. Okay, so now it's a fact about unitary transformations that they keep the inner product between states constant. Let me just give you some evolves to some unitary. So, and then I can have the same thing okay, if I have these equations. Then if I take the inner product here, I have U dagger, because I'm taking the conjugate, U, take that. That's the inner product of V and S. But because this is unitary, this is equal to 1. And so we have so you can see that unitary products leave the inner product unchanged. So that must be true here as well. So let's take the inner product of these two. I'll do it here. So we have I'm just going to write down the answer because I think you can see the steps. So I'm taking the inner product of the left-hand sides. So I get that on the left-hand side, and that's got to be equal to the inner product on the right-hand side. And I get this twice. I get two copies now on the times up. So if you look at this equation, there's one way of satisfying this equation is to say that that this is equal to 0. Okay. But that means that phi and psi and phi are equal to each other. Sorry, orthogonal to each other. So if we assume they're not zero, assume this inner product is not zero, then we can cancel one copy of this inner product, and we get this is just the inner product. This is just equal to 1. We assume we initially normalize our states. So then we get 1 equals what was that? This thing here has to have magnitude which is less than or equal to 1. And consequently, this thing here would have to have magnitude which is greater than or equal to 1. Yep.
To say that, wouldn't you have to divide by 0? Because you have psi inner product phi on both sides of the equation, so you just have 0 equals 0?
No, I said I considered the case where it's equal to 0. Okay, and that's where it's orthogonal. Now let's assume this is not 0.
Oh, no, I see.
Okay, now assume. And so now we can cancel. Okay, so we're considering the other case. And so now we see that, in fact, this inner product has to be greater than or equal to 1, the magnitude of it. The inner product can't actually be greater than 1, it has to be equal to 1. Okay. Okay, so so that would mean that the two states are equal up to some arbitrary phase factor. Up to some phase factor which doesn't really matter from a physical point of view. Okay. So but we were assuming you could clone any two states. So it turns out that doesn't work. In fact, you can only clone states that belong to that are either equal or orthogonal. And it's not possible to clone two states which are not equal nor orthogonal. Okay. So basically you can clone the classical information. You can clone classical information which is encoded in a set of states if they're all orthogonal. But you can't clone the quantum information. Okay. Any questions on that? Yeah, go ahead.
Why did you explicitly include the machinery in your formulation?
Why?
I could see that if things got entangled, you'd have to, but I can't see how the machinery can be entangled with the state. It's an arbitrary state, which is there before the machinery is even talked about.
So you're asking why up there did I include the machinery?
Well, is it necessary to include the machinery?
Well, I mean, you're trying to think of the most general situation, the most general way in quantum theory you could go about cloning something. And so you imagine bringing in some machine, some other state, to help you do that. Now, it could be that at some intermediate stage, you have entanglement between your machine and your other system. But at the end, we're aiming to have that, which isn't entangled. So, there's an alternative proof of the no cloning theorem, which uses entanglement, which is also interesting. And it's interesting that there are these two very different proofs. This one uses the unitarity property that I discussed there. Yeah. I don't remember it. There may be a homework or a tutorial problem with the other approach. Is that right? There is. Okay.
Could you explain again why the fact that you cannot here you can only clone orthogonal states?
Yeah.
And this you said is a characteristic of a classical machine.
Yeah.
And this differentiates it from being a quantum machine.
What I'm saying is you start off with the assumption that I can clone any state, and you get a contradiction, which is that you can actually only clone states that are orthogonal. So the assumption fails. That's what I'm saying. Now, if you had a set of states which were all orthogonal and you knew what those states were, okay, then you could build a machine that would clone them. That's not surprising because you could also just make a measurement, see which one you had, make a measurement in the same basis, see which state you had, and then make as many copies of it as you wanted. So what would be surprising would be, what's interesting is if you can make copies of states which have some non-zero inner product, but they're not orthogonal. That's what would be interesting. Any more questions? Yep, go ahead.
Are we assuming that if psi and phi are not orthogonal, the inner product just becomes one, or?
If psi and phi are not orthogonal.
Yes.
If they're not orthogonal and they're not equal, okay, then the inner product would be somewhere between 0 and 1. So here's an example. Imagine I had phi is just equal to 0, and phi is equal to a0 plus b1. Then the inner product is equal to A. Assuming this is normalized, we assume that B is non-zero, then A has to be less than 1 And we're assuming this is not equal, so A is greater than zero. So we have two states which are not equal to each other, and they're not orthogonal. And these two states, you can't clone them. So that means if someone gives you one of these two states, but they don't tell you which one in advance, then you can't make a copy of it. Okay. So I give you a box. Inside it has a qubit in one of these two states, and your job is to make another copy of that, so you then have two copies, and you can't do that. That's what the theorem tells you. It's very simple, and in some sense very profound. In fact, I would say it's really maybe the first hint that the subject of quantum information might be interesting, because quantum information is something you can't clone. It makes it, I think, a much more interesting phenomena. Yeah. You had a question.
Yeah, you've got this assumption here that the thing is normalized, but it's not necessarily normalized.
Yeah.
Can you take the equation greater than or equal to one and actually achieve that by using normalized states?
So I think, you might be referring back to the axioms I had on Wednesday.
To some extent, I'm just thinking, you haven't said when you clone,
yeah,
you are cloning normalized states. You've said you're cloning states, period.
Yeah, so I think if for consistency reasons you want all your probabilities to lie between 0 and 1, and you have states which are super normalized, is that the word? Have normalization, have magnitude greater than 1, then you're going to get probabilities which are also greater than 1. So you could certainly mathematically try to do that, leverage that, and allow these things to be, allow the inner product to be. You could do that if you allow your states to have normalization greater than one, but then you have to deal with the fact that you have probabilities in your theory which are greater than one as well, and that it would normally be regarded as non-physical. Any more? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So the problem is, say you would be able to clone, right?
Yeah.
You would perform the measurements on this COFIS, right? And then you'd be able to infer information about the original.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you basically perform a measurement on it without performing the measurement. So you're saying.
Yeah. So it's sort of. Yeah. I think. So imagine if you could clone, then you just keep doing it. Then you could have as many copies as you want.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
And then you could easily establish all the information about that quantum state.
Right.
By making measurements on it, and so you would, like you say, be able to. And so cloning is almost an intermediate. Well, it seems like it's an intermediate an intermediate thing between doing nothing and a strong measurement where you look. So it's interesting. It turns out you can't do it. So with regard to that question, because if you could do this, you could just make two copies and then keep going. Then of course you can measure everything about the state. However, what's interesting is that people some years later thought about approximate cloning. Okay, so this is where you don't clone perfectly, like suggested in those equations, but you allow your two copies to be similar to the original state. So you have two copies which are, according to some measure, quite similar to the original copy, but not exactly equal to it. And then you actually can do that. And you can place bounds on how well you can do that. I don't have notes on that paper. It was Buzek and Hillary were the two authors on the original paper. And then if you make another copy, then you get even less fidelity. The states are even less like the original one. And so that kind of solves that problem, because the copies are approximate, and the more you make, the more approximate they are, the less faithful to the original one they are. Then it ends up sort of, it doesn't violate quantum theory. And another thing you can do is you can build a cloning machine. So that paper I just mentioned, Buzek and Hillary, you build a cloning machine that builds approximate states. Another thing you can do is you can say, you can pick a finite set of states, like two states here, which are not equal to each other and not orthogonal. And you can ask to have a machine which may succeed or may fail to clone them. If it fails, well, it tells you I failed. if it succeeds, it then produces two copies. Okay, and that's possible as well. There's a paper, I don't have the reference, that shows how you can do that for some sets of states. Yeah?
If you use quantum state tomography on a finite state, you can, in a finite amount of time, determine its exact properties. And then if you know its exact properties, you can then reproduce it.
Are you thinking of protected measurement?
I'm thinking of using quantum state tomography where you basically measure multiple times the same state.
Yeah.
You have the same state, you can measure it multiple times. And if the state has a finite dimension, then in a finite amount of time, you can discover the exact state.
So then you need many copies of that state.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of consistent with what I'm saying. You still need to have, you can't just do that. If someone just gives you a single copy, you can't do tomography. You need to have a sufficiently large number.
Very large number.
There are other schemes. There's a fantastic wrong scheme showing that you can do this, but I should pull out that wrong scheme sometime, and it's often these wrong things are instructive. But there's a fantastic wrong scheme sort of trying to do that, where you keep reviving the original state, but it goes wrong somewhere. There's an interesting research by Weidman and others called protective measurement, and this is where you can establish the state of a quantum system. You can make measurements to establish the quantum state of a quantum system, as long as but there's certain restrictions there. You have to know the You use something called weak measurement, and then you have to the Hamiltonian has to satisfy certain properties. It has to be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So there's an interesting scheme as well, which I won't go into. So any other questions before I move on? Yeah, go ahead.
So how about if we take non-unitary processes? If the process is not unitary?
Okay, so. It's a good question. So there's two kinds of answer to that. So one kind of answer is to say we consider what are called completely positive maps. So this in quantum theory, you can consider, I gave you the axioms for pure state quantum theory. You can also write down the axioms for mixed state quantum theory, and then you have processes that take some state that might initially be pure and evolve it into a state that's mixed. And whenever you do that, it's always possible, in fact, to describe the same physics where you introduce an extra system called an ancilla, and then describe the total evolution, in fact, as unitary. Okay, it's called the Steinspring dilation. Okay, and so in that case, the theorem still holds because there really does exist this, mathematically at least, there exists this unitary description. So that's one possible answer. Another kind of answer is you're interested in non-unitary transformations, or non-unitary operators at some kind of fundamental level, and I know you have an interest in that. Then who knows? once you start to consider things which lie outside the sort of axioms of quantum theory that I considered, then I don't know what's going to happen. It might be you get it, it might be you don't, and that would be an interesting question to think about. It might be you can clone. I think if you can clone, then it's bad for your theory. If you have some different version, something which isn't quantum theory, which allows non-unitary transformations of that nature, then that maybe is bad for your theory. How am I doing for time? Okay, so I won't get to the quantum Zeno effect probably, but I'll continue with the one with teleportation. Thank you. So quantum teleportation, this was from 1993, I think. I was at that point shortly after I'd finished my PhD. It was a sort of fantastic result, really. Again, very simple. I think profound. For me, quantum teleportation was really the effect that indicated there was this sort of field of quantum information to explore. So quantum teleportation, I think, is not interesting unless you have the no-cloning theorem. It's the no-cloning theorem that makes quantum teleportation interesting. The idea is you have a way, you have some state that comes in, you have a teleportation scheme, and then the state goes out at the other end. You see, if you had cloning, it would be possible just to make to measure what the state is of the original system, and then send that information classically to the other end and reconstruct it. Okay, and in classical physics, you know, one version of teleportation is where you get into the machine, it copies your state, your classical state, and kills you, and then a copy of that state is made somewhere else. And then you've been teleported, which is disconcerting for various reasons. But one reason it's disconcerting is that you could actually make many copies of yourself, you know, not just one. So putting the quantum in gets rid of that. You have some unknown state comes in, you can't copy it, but you can teleport it. And you can only teleport it to one other location. Okay. So how does it work? You have the original, you have some box that produces entangled systems. They go over to some place here where you make a measurement. It's called a Bell measurement. I'll explain that in a moment. And this is in here comes the system that you want to teleport. Okay, so here's the entangled state. In here comes the system you want to teleport. This measurement has one of four possible answers. So this measurement has four outcomes. And you label the outcomes k is equal to 0, 1, 2, or 3. And then you send the information, the classical information you have, which is the outcome of this measurement. You send it to this particle. So let's give this particle's names. Let's call this A1, A2, A3. So you send this classical information over here to particle A3, and then you perform a unitary transformation on A3, which depends on this outcome. Okay, so it's U sub k. And then what comes out here is a system which is in the same state as the original system going in. Okay, so I'll show you how that works. Let's start off by defining the Bell states. So Bell states are named after John Bell. I don't think he actually wrote down these Bell states. I think they were just named after him. Okay. And so what? Let's see. What we're going to do is we're going to send in some state here. It's going to be some initially arbitrary pure state alpha 0 plus beta 1. And we're going to let this state here be the phi plus state. Okay. So our original state, is alpha 0 plus beta 1. That. Okay. And this is, this here is on system A2, A3. And now it turns out you can write this like so. So what I mean is, if you take this state, you multiply it out, then you take this one and you multiply it out, substituting in these expressions, a whole bunch of terms cancel, this is just equal to this. Okay. Except, this morning I was just checking this and I ran out of time. I may have made a mistake with the maybe plus beta and minus alpha here. So if you want to, as a bonus question, make sure that this is the right form. Anyway, it's cracked up to some signs that don't change the message. Is that clear what I'm saying? Any questions? Okay. Okay. So now, what you do is you make a measurement over here in this Bell basis. So this is a measurement onto one of a set of orthogonal states. I forgot to tell you, these states here are orthogonal. You can quickly check that. If you take any two of these states, take the inner product, you get zero. Okay, it's obvious that these states are orthogonal to these ones. You can also check 0, 0 plus 1, 1 is orthogonal to 0, 0 minus 1, 1, and likewise down here. So those states are orthogonal. So they can be a basis onto which you make a measurement. So you make this measurement, and then you get one of the four results. Okay. And actually, now we've written it down conveniently, so we have expanded it in terms of that basis for particles A1 and A2. So if we get the result that corresponds to the phi plus state, We'll call that the k equals zero result. Then what we have to do over here is perform a certain unitary. Now, in fact, if we get this result, then the state that comes out is already in the right form. So it'll be alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay. So you just do nothing. You just do the identity. So when k equals 0, you just do the identity. What about if we get this here? Well, if we get this outcome corresponding to phi minus, then it's almost in the right form. There's just a minus sign there that we don't want. And so call that u, call that k equals 1. So then we perform this unitary. Okay. What about if we get this one? Then the only thing that's wrong is that we want to change one. We want to swap one and zero. So we have to perform a unitary that swaps one and zero, which is just that. And then finally, if we get this, call that k equals 3, then we have to both change the sign and swap the 1 and the 0. So we have 0, 0, minus 1, and 1. Okay. So just to go through again, the entangled particles come out, we make the Bell measurement, we get a result, we send that result, the classical information, to the other end, and then we make an unitary according to this prescription, and then the state that comes out is the original state that went in. Okay. The probability for each of these terms is equal to 1/4, because the modulus of 1/2 squared is 1/4. These are orthogonal, so that's the probability. So it's random as to which one you're going to get. And that's how the teleportation scheme works. I have a few more things to say on teleportation, but are there any questions at this stage? So, go ahead.
Is there a way to do this and still be left with an entangled pair if we enter the smart qubit?
So you want to be able to teleport and still have this qubit, this entangled pair left over?
By introducing more qubits, if it's possible, by doing something similar processes to still have an entangled qubit between A2 and A3.
Oh, okay.
Because this process
uses entanglements.
Yeah.
Yeah. As I've described it, you have to consume entanglement. That's part of the process. Yeah. So entanglement becomes a resource that enables you to do teleportation. There are interesting phenomena which involve having entanglement as a catalyst. So you have some entanglement. You use the entanglement as a catalyst, but you keep that entanglement afterwards. Those are situations where you have some other state, some other entangled state between Alice and Bob. So let's imagine Alice and Bob have some state. Doesn't matter. Let's call it. I don't want to confuse the notation. Let's call it. I'll just call it psi. Okay. Some general state, Alice and Bob, and they want to transform it to a different state. Phi prime, and there's certain conditions, and they want to do that only by making local operations on each of the two sides and communicating classically. So there's some conditions for when that's possible, if that's all you have, just that. There's some conditions under which you can do that. Now it turns out if you allow there to be an additional state, so some entangled state, so your system is actually this. So you have some entangled state as a catalyst. You can do a bigger class of transformations than you can do without the entangled state as a catalyst. So you use it, but you don't consume it. But that's a different problem from teleportation. It's possible someone has done something interesting along the lines you describe. You know, but by now there's a vast literature on teleportation, and I'm not. I don't know all of it. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. So there's a there's lots of interesting things to say here. One thing is if you start off originally where this system here is actually entangled with some other system, okay. So if this is entangled with some other system over here, and then you do the teleportation scheme as I've described it on this, then what happens is that now you have the same entangled state that you used to have between this one and this system, between the new teleported version and that. So you've swapped the entanglement from being between, let's call this system B4, from being between A1 and B4, to now it's now between A3 and B4, but you have the same entangled state. Okay. So it's sometimes called entanglement swapping. And that has to work because quantum theory at this level is all linear. And so if there's another system in there, the B4 system, you can just put it in here and you'll see that linearly it all goes through the same way. That's one comment. Another comment is one thing that's striking here is if you look at this, so you just have some system alpha 0 plus beta 1. Well, these are complex numbers, okay, and they can take a continuous infinity of possible values. So it seems like you have an infinite amount of information that's being communicated from this end to this end. Because before you do teleportation, the alpha and beta are over here, and afterwards they're over here. And yet you've only sent two classical bits, so one of four possible classical signals. It seems like you've been able to communicate an infinite amount of information using only two classical bits. I think that is, in some ways, surprising. It's not as... now, if you were able to actually read off that classical information at the other end, then you'd have a real problem, but you can't. It's not possible to simply read off the alpha and beta over here. For the kinds of reasons we were discussing earlier, you can't measure them directly. And so, how big a problem that is maybe depends on what you think this quantum state means. If you think it's a real thing, then you have, in some sense, communicated an infinite amount of classical information with a finite number of classical bits. On the other hand, if you think it's more like a state of belief, then you don't have such a problem. Okay. I'm not sure what I believe, incidentally. But, there's another phenomena which is like teleportation. It's kind of dual to teleportation. Let me describe it. And it's called quantum dense coding. So what you have now is you want to send classical information using a qubit. So here I have a qubit travels from Alice to Bob, let's say. And I want to send classical information using that qubit. Well, one thing you can do is you can just prepare the qubit in the zero state to send the classical information to zero. And you can prepare it in the one state to send the classical information one. Okay. And then at the other end, you can make a measurement and read off zero or one. Okay, and in that way, you can use this single qubit to send one classical bit of information. And that's the best you can do if that's all you have. But if you allow yourself to have also an entangled pair of qubits, say that initially in the state phi plus, then you can do better. What you can do is you can perform a unitary transformation, UK, one of these four unitary transformations as I've described them, where K is the bit of is the information you want to transfer. So now, because you have four possible Ks, you have two bits, two classical bits. So you perform this unitary. Now you send this qubit to the other end. And then at the end, you perform a Bell measurement. And using that Bell measurement, you can read off. You see, because I perform this U, it transforms this state between one of four orthogonal states, the Bell basis. And I can now read off what the Bell state was. So I've sent, instead of sending just one classical bit of information, I've managed to send two bits. So it's like this. And you can see it's kind of a dual in some sense to the teleportation. In the original paper, the original teleportation paper from 1993, which I recommend you read, actually. It's very straightforward. They use quantum dense coding to place and teleportation to place limits or bounds on each other. So you don't need, let's see. So they use teleportation to show that you can't communicate more than two classical bits by this kind of scheme. And they used dense coding to show that you need two bits to do the teleportation. Okay, any more questions on teleportation?
I don't understand in this example, what was the advantage? So your goal is you're sending the entangled pair first, and then you're hoping to get more classes.
Yeah, so you imagine a situation where you have this resource of entangled pair of qubits, okay, here. And so you have that resource. And then you also have the ability to send a single qubit from this side, from Alice to Bob. Okay. And with those resources, you're able to send two classical bits of information. Did you understand the scheme whereby you can send two classical bits?
Yeah, so you send two classical bits and they receive two classical
bits. And then he's able to read out two classical bits. Yeah. The question is, what's the maximum amount of information you could send with a single qubit?
Oh,
can I send, with one qubit, can I send five classical bits? Can I send 20? You might think that you could send an infinite amount of classical information with a qubit because a qubit has these real numbers in it. It's got these complex numbers, but it has an infinite number of possible. You might think that you could use that to send an infinite amount of classical information, but you can't. The maximum amount of information you can send is two, which is already more than one. So I think this is this result is surprising in two ways. It's surprising because it's so small, and it's surprising because it's bigger than one. So depending on your perspective, is that clear?
Yeah. Can you do better somehow? Like if you have more entanglement?
If you're able to send a qutrit, so a particle which has one of three levels, and you have entangled states between qutrits, then you can send, I'm going to get this wrong, I think it's 3 squared, so 9 classical signals. Yeah, that's right. It's just a number of orthogonal states in that Hilbert space, which is 9. So yeah. And so on. And likewise, if you want to teleport a system which is bigger than a qubit over here, you want to teleport a qutrit, then you need entanglement between between qutrits. And then you have a bigger basis set. But that exists. You can write down a basis set for two qutrits, a Bell basis set, and so on. So teleportation works for any finite dimension. And dense coding also. Quantum dense coding. Okay. Great. Stop there. I'll do the quantum Zeno effect next week.